the original papers that were written about the analyst unconscious being attuned to the patient's unconscious and picking it up by Paula Hyman and Racker. In both cases, they talk about this phenomenon, but both of them utter a caution, which is that one always has to, it's not said this way, but one always has to take into account one's own mishigas, and that indeed, you know, essentially what they're saying is, you know, the unconscious is pretty individualistic, and we have our own things, and we have to consider that possibly it's our own difficulties or own unconscious that is playing a bigger role in our countertransient reaction to the patient's unconscious.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Fred Bush. Fred Bush is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. Fred is very widely published, and his focus of his writings is on the inner workings of the psychoanalytic experience, in particular psychoanalytic technique. And our conversation today is about his latest book entitled How Does Analysis Cure? Essays on a Psychoanalytic Method, Psychoanalytic Organizations, and Psychoanalysis. And we take the title at its word, that is, how does this process work? People devote their lives to learning it, to practicing it, to teaching it, and patients devote big chunks of their lives to trying to gain the benefits from it. And that's what we discuss. And he shares with us the fundamental method, as I hear his work, is to help individuals learn the freedom to think. We all have aspects of our mind that we don't know are blocked until we do. And then it's a wonderful liberation to be able to be aware, A, that it's blocked, and B, to discover why we feel we need to block it, which tells pieces of our life story. And Fred emphasizes this very aspect to help people understand how their mind works as distinct from the particular contents of their mind. It's a theme throughout his work, this book, our conversation. We take up issues like the nature of countertransference, on how do you deal with silence, on the role of self-analysis, how self-criticisms that patients so struggle with can also be offering them a lifeline. Fred also is an active teacher. He talks to us about some of his experiences as an educator. And he closes to read just one sentence from the closing part. He says, "The wonderful thing about being a psychoanalyst is there are always things to learn and ways to grow." And we actually have a bit of that between us in our conversation. I found it thoroughly enjoyable. I always learn from Fred, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Fred, welcome back to the podcast. It's so good to have you here again. You and I have met and spoken before, and our prior conversations worked around books you've edited. So it's been focused on other people's writings. And today, we're going to speak about your most recent book entitled, How Does Analysis Cure? Essays on a Psychoanalytic Method, Psychoanalytic Organizations, and Psychoanalysts. So we're going to get to the essence of Fred Bush today. And I want to start us off with an experience I had in reading this book. And I've run this by you before, so it isn't going to be a surprise for you to hear this. Just about every page in this book has either a word or a sentence or, in fact, a paragraph that is italicized. And in fact, I paid homage to this by italicizing a word in the title of our podcast. Now, we're going to discuss the implications of when somebody has an imagination about what someone else is thinking, to be very modest about that experience. It may tell us something about what the other person is experiencing. It may not. With that caveat, I wanted to share with you what my experience was of reading the book. And obviously, I had many experiences. But in terms of receiving each page with italics, I had a particular reaction. And it was that this was a man who feels misunderstood or underappreciated. And that the italics was his way of saying, I put a great deal of time, effort, and my heart and soul into these ideas and how to understand them and develop them over my lifetime and to state them as clearly as I can. And it's important to me, the writer, to be understood. And I have this notion that if I italicize ideas that I think are vital, that somehow the reader will have a sense to take this seriously and to devote some small portion of my energy that I put into writing it, into reading it and listening to it. That's my fantasy, Fred. Now, let me ask you where you are in this.
Well, first, let me say what a pleasure it is to be back here talking to you. Every time we've talked, it's been both enjoyable and enlightening for me. So it's a pleasure to be here. And
likewise,
your opening statement is an example. I feel like there are certain, let me put it this way, Harvey, there are certain people that I think, a certain group of people, that really get my work and, you know, are following it. And I know about that, and some I don't know about. But I've had the feeling for some time that when people see the name Fred Bush, they think, oh, he's an ego psychologist. He's just dealing with defenses, or not even the second part. He's an eco psychologist, which means in many people's mind, one can be dismissive then. And there are lots of reasons for that, I think, some of which I agree with and are valid. But you're absolutely correct that some of these things that I italicize, or a lot of these things I italicize, is to differentiate my work of the last 25 years from what I was doing the first 10, about the first 10 years. The first 10 years, I was essentially following Paul Gray's ideas and emphasizing them. About the year 2000, I started realizing that I did differ with Paul in various ways. Like, for example, Paul believed that if you did resistance analysis, then what was underneath the resistances would eventually come out. And while I agree with some of that, I did feel, and I have felt, that you also have to help the patient see what comes out after the resistance analysis, that it has to be talked about, articulated, and build as another representation in the patient's mind. And there are various, you know, techniques that one needs to use in order to do that, which I've emphasized in various places. So I think I was trying to really differentiate myself from Paul and talk about the benefits of what ego psychology has to offer, at least from my perspective, which is a different perspective.
It used to be said, if I'm following you, that if one never names, puts words to that which is being repressed, let's say,
yeah,
then the patient may get the idea that it's unsayable.
Possibly, yeah, that's one idea.
And so you wanna name it, but you're careful, and we're going to touch on this throughout the book. You're always careful to have it not just be an intellectualized understanding. Mm-hmm. That's one of the themes that I took from the book, that that you want to be affectively alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel where I put it somewhere, it has to be affectively alive and intellectually understandable. I think both of those. Another theme that I wrote about early, but I think it's still true, that many interpretations that we make, especially if they're deep interpretations, leave the patient baffled. And it's easy to pick that up and realize that while you may have touched on what affectively is meaningful, the way you presented it to the patient, it's not understandable, cognitively.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think both have to be true.
Let's jump into the book. And I want to start us off by reading the first paragraph of the first chapter. You write, "The capacity of patients to tell and own their stories is central to their developing a sense of well-being from analysis. It is the basis of an exhilarating freedom from stories neurotically imposed by internal and external sources, the stories remembered but never integrated, the stories experienced but never formulated, the stories experienced and remembered only in the language of action, the stories of unconscious fantasy and defense, and the importance of all these in every other story. Another more technical categorization might be that these are the stories of compromise formations and screen memories, stories enacted due to unstable structures or to thoughts represented in action form, and stories based on implicit memories. In short, these are the stories of lives interrupted, manifested analytically, in rigidly held, fearfully unknown, or incomplete stories." It's quite a beginning to a book. You want to, is there anything to say about that, or is it stand on its own?
Just a little history. And sometimes I try to talk about what we're doing in terms other than just using psycholytic terms, so that thinking about patient stories was just another way of talking about, you know, how they've lived their life, and they have all these stories about it, ways of explaining it. Another example I used was a paper I wrote on talking to strangers, and how we need to approach what we're trying to bring up for the patient. It's a stranger to them. It's not something that they're aware about. So, like with any stranger, I mean, you move very carefully, and you don't start talking about intimate things or unconscious things, in the case with the patient, without any lead up to the patient getting to know why you're talking about these things. So this is just another example of some of the metaphors I found to use that I think help explain what we're doing without psycholytic terms.
All right. You then say a couple of pages in that what's important to you is to highlight the importance of understanding the patient's way of thinking rather than only focusing on the content of what patients think. And that, again, is a key point, that their way of thinking is what you would like to familiarize them with. And do you think that sets you apart from how analysis is generally thought of?
Yeah, it's something I think, this is something the French analysts think about. And Betty Joseph once talked about this. But in general, I don't think it's something that most analysts think about. See, I find this invaluable, especially when I feel I'm at some stalemate with a patient, or I'm not getting what's going on, or they're not familiar themselves with what's going on. And then I look at what I call the process, and that is what the way the patient is talking, rather than necessarily what they're talking about, because that may give us a clue as to some, let's call it language action, that is taking place that the patient and the analyst don't know anything about and needs to be talked about and brought to the surface in order to move ahead in terms of the content.
I'm selecting bits and pieces. We're going to work our way towards what I have underlined as three central ideas of the book. It's sort of idiosyncratic. One could choose many of ideas as central, but these three jumped out. But these are sort of like appetizers that help us approach it. You write, the closer we come to what is unconscious, the more likely patients will express themselves via action. The deeper we go into the unconscious, and it is useful to think of gradients in the unconscious, the more thought is equated with action. What is more unconscious is always enacted. Think of our most disturbed patients, where in the areas of their disturbance, thoughts are closer to reflex actions. As Lowell noted, the deeper one goes in psychoanalysis, the greater likelihood the patient will express themselves in the language of action. Now, what I found useful about that is to think of what you call the gradients of the unconscious. And it's more colloquially thought of, we get deeper, but gradients, I think, add something to it. But as I sat with that and tried it on, and maybe this is why I underlined it for us to talk about, it doesn't exactly match my experience in the following way. The deeper, to use your words, the deeper we go into the unconscious, and now I would add, the more the unconscious tends to live in the transference, and the fear of the transference is what leads action to predominate. And perhaps this is a semantic difference, perhaps not. I'm not sure what you think, because you don't make mention of how we get deeper in the unconscious, how that tends to be expressed in the transference imaginings, fantasies, desires, and then they take on the conflict.
Tricky question for me. Harvey, let me just go back to the previous point, talking about a patient's process and how they're presenting material rather than what the content is. So, I mean, yesterday it comes to mind that a patient was talking, and he's talk about different things that were going on, and then she would interpret it. And the interpretations would usually be last week's interpretations or yesterday's interpretations. And to me, this is a way of forestalling any kind of freedom to think about whatever the patient wants to think about. So that's what I mean by talking about the process, that the way patient is presenting material one way or another, like this patient with making these interpretations.
And we will get to that phrase, which is both a phrase and a concept throughout the book. You could have titled this book The Freedom to Think, because that's really what you're devoted to free up people's minds so that they could own it and go to places they didn't even know they were there.
Right. And those are the ones that get us in, as patients, into trouble. You know, those areas that are there that are driving us one way or another, and we have no awareness of it.
Right.
Yeah. And so the capacity to think about that or anything that the patient wants is it's an incredible freedom I think patients get from treatment.
It's a real gift. It's a gift of analysis. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Depth. But more recently struck me that when we talk about the unconscious, we talk about it like it's just one thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my own clinical experience led me to understand that it's not just one thing. There were, you know, well, actually, Freud said it earlier that when he discovered that there are parts of the preconscious that have all the ingredients of what's in the unconscious, an unconscious fantasy. And he came to realize that this was something close to the line that he has in his 1933 drawing of the unconscious and the permeable barrier to the preconscious. And then in that drawing, you know, it goes down and down and down to a bottomless hole. And I think, you know, I think I may differ from a lot of people that while I think of the transference as, you know, obviously important, I spend a lot of time in the external transferences, talking about what the patient is talking about in terms of their, you know, their spouse, their best friend, their children, the guy in the grocery store, that sort of thing, that patients are always talking about in terms of their life. And I find it more useful to start working there than bringing it into the immediacy of the session. Because I think patients, when they're talking about these external objects and their interactions with them, that's where their affect is at that time in the sessions. So it becomes, to me, somewhat artificial to then bring it into the transference, unless I can demonstrate a clear link to the transference.
And we're going to read a little piece that specifies that way of thinking of yours precisely. But just to draw a finer point on it, when I say it gets expressed in the transference or conflicted in the transference, I don't mean to be saying that one should therefore necessarily speak to it, but one could have it in one's mind that this also likely has some reverberation with their yet to be explored experience in the office, and this may not be the time to address it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Comport more with your thinking? Yeah. To stay on this point, but to sort of put a toe in the world of how one listens to clinical material, which we're going to get to a little down the road, you write, listening to discussions of the clinical process, one is impressed with how many interpretations seem based less on what the patient is capable of hearing and more on what the analyst is capable of understanding. Less on what the patient is capable of hearing, which is a segue from the last thing you and I just said, which is we could have in our mind the idea that this seems to relate to energy and conflict between us. But for the moment, what the patient could hear is vis-a-vis their boss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Now to what I have categorized as these three central ideas. And the first is in a chapter that you've called Ethical Countertransference. Now, I must say, that's not my favorite chapter title, because it for someone who doesn't know this work of yours, might think that calling it ethical countertransference implies that people who see it differently are therefore, dare say, unethical, and that's obviously not your point at all. But let me read just a piece of what you mean in this concept of the countertransference. You write, most analysts would agree with Pine that the mind is both internally driven and relationally responsive. However, with the introduction of the concept of the relational unconscious, the individual mind is taken out of the equation, and it is proposed that countertransference reactions need to be considered a creation of the dyad. Instead of offering this idea as an addition to psychoanalytic understanding, it is presented as a replacement for our previous, more cautious ideas, making irrelevant the role of our individual psyches in countertransference occurrences. And you later then say, from this perspective, the individual unconscious awaits elaboration in the experience with another. There is no individual mind able to reflect upon itself. Again, a central thesis of yours. You want to elaborate a bit?
Well, yeah, this is only one point I made in this chapter.
Yes.
This came to me as I wrote a book on the analyst's reveries, in which I talk about the post-Bionian use of reverie, where the many post-Bionians that I talked about in the book, they use their unconscious as if it was perfectly attuned with the patient's unconscious. So the patient may be talking about something and the analyst has a thought about something that seems unrelated, but the post-Bionians think of it as related in some way. Now, what's interesting is the original papers that were written about the analyst's unconscious being attuned to the patient's unconscious and picking it up by Paula Hyman and Racker. In both cases, they talk about this phenomenon, but both of them utter a caution, which is that one always has to, it's not said this way, but one always has to take into account one's own mishigas, and that indeed, you know, essentially what they're saying is, you know, the unconscious is pretty individualistic, and we have our own things, and we have to consider that possibly it's our own difficulties or own unconscious that is playing a bigger role in our countertransference reaction to the patient's unconscious. And I had thought for some time that when I have, and I've tried to practice this, when I have a thought about, you know, it seems to come from nowhere about what's going on.
Sure.
Let me bring up another term. Dana Bergstein Breen, who was the editor of the IJP, she had this notion of, I can't remember her own phrase, but essentially what she was saying is that, oh, reverberation time. When one has one of these thoughts, you have to give it some time to see how it reverberates over time. So that, which is what I, you know, had come to on my own, that, you know, I take time to analyze what that thought might be about and see how much might be coming from the patient and how much from me. It is interesting that when Bion talked about the analyst's reveries, he said somewhere that you can't tell what's a reverie at the time that the reverie comes up. You have to give it some time before you can tell it's a reverie. So that's essentially my point, that one has to take time to treat these countertransferences as, you know, something like any countertransference that we have to think about and wonder about where it's coming from.
Let me nudge that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because one could hear what you're saying is, don't take one's own imaginings when in the presence of a patient too literally and just assume that they therefore reveal a truth about what's happening in the patient. Obviously, fair enough. But then you're suggesting perhaps that one spend a great deal of energy and focus on is it or isn't it, while acknowledging that we will never know the answer to that question with any confidence or precision. And so if we do have confidence in our ability to listen to the patient's reaction to our saying it, because that's ultimately the test of whether it's useful, not whether we deem it to be accurate or useful, but how the patient associates to it immediately down the road and next week, that's what will tell us if it was a meaningful and useful intervention to deepen the treatment. So I guess I'm leaning away from being too careful to try to discern where it's coming from without being reckless, and saying, well, it feels like it is, parentheses, I can't be sure, but let me try it and see what happens with it and see if, in fact, it does deepen the patient's experience, which will tell me something about its usefulness. And that changes the focus to, instead of studying our mind so carefully, to listening to the patient's mind more carefully. What do you think?
I'd rather do it my way.
Okay, I think that's a perfectly fair response. Now, about this issue of transference, let me jump ahead, because the next significant idea is a chapter called The External Transferences. And again, this is continuing your very point, where you write, few psychoanalysts would disagree with the importance of transference interpretations to the success of the treatment. I would add, however, that it is only if a transference interpretation is made at a time when the analyst can experience the transference as emotionally experienced in the presence, while also being able to intellectually understand it. It is my sense that if these requirements aren't met, transference interpretations are only understood intellectually and are generally used by patients defensively, if at all. In general, I find analysts looking for the transference rather than finding it. We tend to be more eager to bring the transference into the room rather than finding it in the room. We could spend time on that. You want to start us off?
This just comes from, a long time doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
That I have found that, as I said before, patients are most aware of being and reacting to people in their life, mm-hmm. other than animals, father, mother, spouse, children, the butcher, or anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they talk about.
Right.
And to translate that into transference between the patient and the analyst takes a number of bridges that have to be made. If the patient will give me some hint in what they're saying, that there's something that may be going on in an immediate transference between us that may be similar. Or, once you've had a longer analysis and the patient is talking about X, Y, and Z, I think it's easier to bring it into the transference using data. I'll call it data. What the patient has presented before that you know about. So, it's based upon things that you may have pointed out as going on in the here and now of the transference, as an action, for example. What I mean by that is a patient, again, talking in a particular way that gives you an idea something's going on here in terms of the two of us. So I guess that's all I want to say. I usually wait a long time before bringing it into the transference.
You introduced a new variable that I hadn't heard you say, nor do I think it's in the book, which is the timing in the trajectory of the analysis, that you are differentially cautious or careful at the beginning, middle, versus towards the end, when there's an ease and a flow between the two of you, and the past and the present are very familiar as they interdigitate for both of you. And that's an important thing for me to understand about your thinking.
Yeah. So I've done a lot of second analyses, I'm sure you have, and these patients who have had transference-based analyses will come and say, they'll have some feeling and they'll say, oh, that's my mother or that's my father, blah, blah, blah. And it's clear that this was an interpretation that was made to him in previous analysis. And, it may have been true at that time, but they've glommed onto it as a defense against thinking about it a bit more.
And feeling it. I mean, it's the trap that you are so focused on, which is to try to have it be more than just a cognitive awareness. You don't want your patient walking out of the office and say, oh, my analyst thinks that this has to do with me and my mother. And it's meaningless. And we have worn that yoke for a long time, and people have gone through very, very long treatments with, and could write long essays about their, you know, supposed unconscious pasts and present, but it hasn't touched them, and something hasn't come alive in the office. And you're devoted to that.
Exactly.
Let me then go to what I think is, I have it as the third large idea, but for me is actually my favorite in the book, because it's not usually stated, I think, as clearly as you state it. And that's your chapter entitled Self-Criticism as an Unconscious Lifeline. Self-criticism as an unconscious lifeline. And you, just to give a little example, you are describing a patient who has terrible self-criticism, real rumination, and you write, "The patient's identification with their mother's critical view as the difficult or hated one, and who anticipates criticism from others, keeps the mother present and serves as a form of ground zero for the patient's stable connection to life. When not experiencing criticism, these patients experience the fear of a terrifying void. This is what makes the identification so difficult to give up. Its identification as a lifeline is central to the outcome of the treatment."
Yeah. Do you want to say something, Harry?
I do. I think it's very powerful. It's so easy to get caught up, and it's probably inevitable to get caught up on either side of the sadomasochism that people are ruminating about. And there's no avoiding that. But you say that it's serving as a compromise or a defense against experiencing a void if they lose that connection. And I think clinical experience will testify to that. But further, my sense is that the void itself then keeps a distance for the patient from a libidinal attachment, often, to go back to this transference theme, often to the analyst. That is, it is easier to feel ruminatively criticized and attached to one's harsh mother than to be separate from that, which is its own challenge, and to realize that that passion, the passion of that self-abuse, that passion can be flipped from a negative sign to a positive sign, and it can be a sign of how full the passion is, again, not in a self-abusive side, but in the libidinal side, and loving the analyst, loving their partner, loving whoever. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point, because I think these two things are usually linked. That is, the need for self-criticism and the distance from the analyst. Lack of an ability to invest in the analyst, or until a long time takes place. And, you know, it came to me, it started with, you know, seeing a lot of patients with this attachment to self-criticism. And at first, when I was starting out, I would try and boost their sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so, for sure.
You know, they wouldn't feel so self-critical. They would have none of it.
Yeah, we've all been through that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, we're nice people. You don't want to see someone suffer. You say, don't treat yourself so badly. Sure, sure.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So that led me to think about this and found this particular dynamic in a number of patients. So, and still finding it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, you sort of demonstrate it, and I want to, there are many clinical examples in the book. Some are brief, some are longer vignettes. And I've selected a very brief exchange you had with a patient because it demonstrates two points. Number one, it shows how your interventions along the lines of defense analysis work. That's one reason. And the other is a little different than that. And that is that so often in male-male analytic dyads, when the analysand is intensely involved with his male analyst, and the analysand brings up some reference to a woman, so often I hear the analyst or supervisor or discussant be very quick to assume that that puts us in the realm of triangularity and rivalry and conflicted competition. And that's the direction of the interventions, speaking about not finding the surface. And I think you quite beautifully just stay with the patient. And the example is as follows. This is Mr. L is a 45-year-old man who, staying to the point of self-critical, you describe him as relentlessly self-critical. And he comes in and he says, I've had that feeling a number of times during the session. I don't know why I didn't bring it up. And he pauses. I'm thinking of something which doesn't make sense yet. When I come in here and you're ready to deal with me as a man, I feel like I can't do that. I back away. When I would talk to an attractive woman at the conference, I couldn't keep my mind on what we were talking about and I drifted to sexual thoughts. Then I would talk myself into saying, nothing is going to happen, and I could get back in the conversation. The analyst says, it seems then it's your sexual thoughts and feelings that lead you to pull back from me. Next day, patient comes in. I'm thinking about what we should talk about. I should focus on what we talked about yesterday. I know it's important as I see it happening all the time. I'm talking with someone and I start to feel like pulling back. I say to myself, we're not going to have sex. And then I could get back into the conversation and I feel so much more real. It took me a while to get back to thinking about it yesterday. I feel like I want to escape from it. I'm not sure what it is. It's still vague to me right now. I need to get to something concrete. I too am starting to feel vague. Analyst says, I wonder if with your vagueness, you're pulling us back from your fears that having me too interested might lead you to feel excited and want to jump into my arms, which is something that had been brought up before. And you write to the reader at this point, here again, I'm clarifying the enacted defense and feel it's important to bring in fear, as he's already mentioned it. Patient says, and you note he's surprised, I completely blocked that part out. I knew there was something important I was missing. Now it's clear, the part about jumping into your arms. Comments?
I forget where that was an example of, Harvey, remind me.
It was an example of, the obvious thing was how you intervene on the side of defense, how you bring someone's avoidance and vagueness and changing the subject, including changing the subject from his feelings in the room with you to his feelings that he was able to represent and enact in his mind with a woman. Mm-hmm. That's really the essence of the point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was, he had been in analysis for a while at this point, and you can see how when I reminded him of what he talked about being afraid of earlier, that, and linking it, I think I linked it with the vagueness he was experiencing in the session, that he then can see what's happening in the session. And that's, to me, that's such an important moment in an analysis when we can see something new and see its causative factor at the same time. That is his fear of whatever that meant, you know, his jumping into my arms. It could have at that point, could have meant many different things. But to connect that pulling away and being vague with this fear that he could see immediately, to me, is an incredible achievement. That, I mean, in some ways, it doesn't sound like much, but obviously. No,
not to anybody who's been in the trenches. We know how difficult it is to help someone, again, gain the freedom of thought. You really just said one thing about sort of there's the vagueness keeping you at a distance. And he was able to go right back into the moment and claim his realness, his realness. Yeah. And what better thing to help someone discover?
Yeah. Yeah. Well put.
Moving along, you have a chapter called Silence on Silence. And you write, a way we often deal with silence is to ask a question about what the patient isn't talking about. A not uncommon question in response to silence is, what are you thinking? This focus on the hidden content and not the hiddenness itself. Again, that's a focus on the content, not the hiddenness. And at the end of that chapter, you give, I think, a really nice historically based description. You mention Strachey, whose thinking was built on the topographic model, and then Richard Sterber, whose thinking was built on the structural model. And you write, "It is my understanding that the major reason we haven't viewed ruptured silences as significant moments to analyze is that much of the analytic world has followed the Strachey model, the topographic model, where the interferences in the patient's associations were viewed as less important than the content of the associations before and after the silence. However, it is my impression that as we have moved to an acknowledgement that there is not only an unconscious to be discovered, but a way of thinking to be developed, the recognition that silence can be an interference with the freedom to think leads one to a greater appreciation of the need to analyze this wish to stop thinking."
I like that too.
You know, isn't it a nice thing when I read something you wrote and you said, "Hey, I'm pleased with that." Is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, you know, this came from, you know, supervising so many people and reading so many articles that where silence is dealt with in terms of like nothing, you know, it's not a psychological event that's happening right at that moment in the analysis. And to me, that seemed impossible.
It's missing the point, sure.
Yeah, something's happening. And so I don't think the answer to find out what that silence is about to ask the patient what they were thinking.
Right, sure.
Right. Because that bypasses the whole reason for the silence.
It's to get them curious about the silence.
Yeah. So,
Fred, in the book, you go beyond the kind of material we've been discussing, and you have a section on gossip, on being a good enough discussant, on writing, on education in institutes. And when we spoke prior to our speaking now in anticipation of this, you made a point that you wanted us to take up the issue of gossip because it was important to you. And let me read just a brief section of it, and then I'm going to ask you about it. You write, "In my experience, the essential element of the gossiping dyads I've described, where it's a senior colleague gossiping about something, which begins, 'I probably shouldn't be telling you this,' it involves a seductive invitation into the primal scene. The listener is invited to engage in auditory voyeurism as the gossip opens a door to what should remain hidden. The feeling of excitement accompanied by the sense of discomfort mirrors the feeling of the patients we see as adults who experience premature sexual excitement with parents or older siblings."
Yeah, I mean, on the face of it, it sounds like one of these wild interpretations that I'm talking against. But I did try and point to various things that have appeared in the literature, I mean, not in the psychoanalytic literature, but in other literature, and you know, analyzing some of my own feelings when this has happened to me. Obviously, this is based in part upon personal experience, and so, you know, the one article that talks about gossip in the psychoanalytic literature is by a guy named Stanley Olnick, who talks about analysts gossiping about patients. And that's not what I was talking about, but he linked it to, I can't remember exactly, something sexual. And in the sociological literature, when they talk about gossip, they talk about the beginning of gossip started around the women who were gathered around the bed of someone who was going to giving birth. And this is where gossip started. And it can serve many purposes. But I think in psychoanalysis, in the situation that I talked about, where a senior analyst is saying, you know, "I really shouldn't tell you this." And, you know, I know what, you know, I probably in my most well thought out moment, I probably should have said, "Well, I guess I shouldn't hear it."
Right. But we all are seduct. Yeah. We're open to the seduction. Sure.
Yeah. I sort of excited to have the curtain pulled back.
Exactly. Yeah.
From the Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm. There's so much more we could choose from the book, but let me turn to an essay that you have in the book about education, and let me ask you to read a piece of your experience.
Okay.
Page 188.
I start, before I'm reading, I'm talking about the clinical seminars I lead, and I usually, I tell the candidates that I'm working in a particular way that may have been different from some of the things they've heard about or ways they've been taught. And I just wish that they try and take it in and then see where it leads them in their own work or in comparison to other things they've heard. So, then I say, seminars are usually lively and helpful to all of us. I'm frequently challenged in the best sense, which I find helpful, to modify or clarify my thinking. Still, I consider myself an authority on thinking and aspects of clinical technique from my perspective. I'm talking about my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, as I was teaching an advanced group of candidates, when in the midst of a discussion, a candidate interrupted to say she liked the previous way a clinical seminar was taught, where everyone sat around and just said what he or she thought about the case. It was at that point I realized what had only been in the background of my mind, that a new era in psychoanalytic institutes had arrived, a kumbaya moment, the era of false democratization. That is, we were now all the same, no one knew anything more than anyone else, and everyone was supposed to be nice. No one needed to be taught, if indeed there was anything to be taught. Rather, our job had become to help candidates find his or her own analytic voice. Skorzeny reports on how a candidate felt demoralized in the seminar. This candidate said, "It made me feel like a novice who could never really understand psychoanalysis. Not to mention practice it like my instructors, who are experts in the field." The author then takes this as face value as the result of problem teaching, which it may well have been. But are we to say candidates should never feel like a novice, which in terms of practicing psychoanalysis, they are?
You continue a couple of pages down, and you say, "In a very short period of time, we seem to have moved from a rebellion against the authoritarianism that ruled psychoanalysis to an authoritarian anti-authority."
Exactly.
So, exactly. You wrote it. But just share with us what your experience and understanding of this is in terms of the now and in terms of the future.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's true in all institutes, but in many institutes, I found this attitude of, let me give an example. I was teaching a seminar and all the candidates presented cases. And there was this one candidate who, contributed a lot to the dialogues we were having, but he would often say, "In my experience," and use that as the basis for some knowledge he was importing. And he was a second-year candidate. And so his experience was mostly in psychotherapy, taught in a hospital setting. And it seemed like we weren't supposed to question that particular view of "in my experience," and not talk to him about his experience is very limited in terms of psychoanalysis.
The challenge, I think, for both educators and for candidates is to find the sweet spot. That is, we don't want patients to be stuck in an idealization of their teachers so that their own minds can't play with the ideas of the teacher. And we don't want them to not recognize that the teachers do have real experience and have something to add. And yet the infantilization that often people are drawn to and rebel against is also problematic. Neither of those make for a creative and attentive and creative candidate learning experience. And we as the educators do need to help them, and obviously some are more or less receptive to this, to, yes, we know things that you don't know because we've been doing this for a long time. That's not to say we're not interested in your thinking, and we're not. It's not to say we're not interested in what it's like for you to be learning this, because it, you know, as we all know, it's a very difficult thing to learn, and it's filled with uncertainty and anxieties and affects and fantasies that are very unsettling. So it's a tough enterprise, and I think your point is that it is tough for teachers. Because we are subjected to the unsettledness of candidates, and it's tough for candidates as well.
Yeah, I just realized as we were talking that what this candidate did was something, I know that I thought of it, that I used to think when I first started analytic training, I thought, well, you know, what's the difference between this and that? You know, so
yeah. Much ado about nothing, right? Yeah, yeah.
Maybe this is why it affected, well, not maybe, it's probably why it affected me more.
I'm glad we can have a moment that will allow your mind to go there, Fred, speaking of freedom of thought. Let me ask you to close by reading from the last page of your book, and that's on page 197.
The wonderful thing about being an analyst is that there are always things to learn and ways to grow. We need to think carefully about how to respectfully treat our candidates as adults and assume they have come to psychoanalytic institutes to learn psychoanalysis. In this context, constructive criticism is a necessary part of the learning process. Many candidates are hungry for someone to think deeply about them and help them in their development as analysts.
You know, and in that paragraph, I underlined that word. They're hungry for someone to think deeply about them. And it brings us back to our beginning today, Fred, with our italics. And what I took to be your wish for us to think deeply about your deeply developed thoughts over the years. And I hope I and you and I today have honored that, because they are worthy of deep thoughts. And a careful reader of your work, this in particular, will find the next day they're in the office a little more interesting, perhaps, or a little more alive and thought-provoking. And perhaps they will discover a richer freedom to think, which would certainly match my sense of your goal in writing this. So, Fred, as always, it's a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
You too, Harvey. You know, I always enjoy our conversations. I think you are a deep reader of all the material that you talk about. And as psychoanalysts, we all appreciate it very much.
That's kind. Thank you much. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.